Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Jonathan Jansen is the first black president of the University of the Free State in South Africa. He's a dedicated educator with a formidable reputation for his commitment to reconciliation in a racially divided society. We'll talk with him about his career, about transformational leadership, and about the future of Mandela's Rainbow Nation. Jonathan Jansen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You were appointed vice chancellor and rector of the University of the Free State in 2009, becoming the first black to lead the university in its more than 100-year history. Describe to us what the environment, what the climate was like when you took office.
Well, the university had just had a horrible racial incident, which, without which I'm quite convinced I wouldn't have gone there or they wouldn't have invited me. And everything was very deeply divided. The black students were separated almost completely from the white students in every way.
And you're referring to the Ritz video.
That's right, yeah.
Where describe what that is.
Well, in effect, it was four white male Afrikaans-speaking students who were protesting racial integration in the residences. And the way they did that was to record a series of interactions with five black workers, four of whom were women, twice their ages. And the women participated, thinking this just was an innocent, you know, sort of interaction with guys they knew.
And had a decent relationship
with. And had a fairly decent relationship with them, but they were in fact abusing them. And at one stage appeared to urinate into food, which they get the workers to ingest. And you can imagine when this video broke on YouTube and went viral, as the kids say, I mean, the university became notorious, you know, for everything having to do with racism, et cetera, et cetera. And the university authorities then decided that one way in which to try and get out of this rut was to bring in people who knew about racism and had worked with these kinds of issues in higher education.
And that was you.
And I had just written a book, Knowledge in the Blood, which dealt with this kind of stuff. And so they invited me over there, and I was quite interested to see how one could go about changing a very old university. But when I got there, I was astounded because, you know, that had been a number of years after 1994 when we got democracy. So I was astounded by the level of segregation in everything from the classrooms to the residence halls to the open spaces on campus and so on. And I assembled a team and said, we're going to try and change this. And I've been there now for almost 4.5 years.
And a lot of people weren't exactly thrilled with what you did. These four students, they were suspended,
yes.
They were fined heavily,
yes.
And they were actually sentenced, but their jail sentence was suspended. You invited them back to the university to finish their education.
Yeah, and there was a specific reason for that, and that was that the institution, which is as a history, you know, of white nationalism, and segregation, had in fact given the impression that these were just four rotten apples and that the institution itself, you know, was innocent of what had happened. And I said, oh no, we have to, now that I'm head of the institution, we have to take responsibility for creating the kind of environment in which these young people thought this was normative. You could get away with it, okay? They wouldn't have done this if they knew it. And so we went and did a series of public, you know, events in which we said, as a university, we say sorry to decent black people, to decent white people, all of whom have been hurt by this stuff, and we take responsibility for the fact that we produce these kinds of young people. And so in doing that, we also say sorry to them and invite them back in order to correct the bad behavior. Now, by this point, they were both in the criminal and the civil courts, you know, judgments against these young people. And so this wasn't substituting for social justice. This was saying that having happened, is there a way of bringing them back, not unconditionally, but in a way that opened the road for reconciliation with the people they humiliated. They were quite happy to go through that. The workers, astoundingly, were very big-hearted, you know, and wanted that. And that's the story of that particular process.
The last story in your book, We Need to Talk, which is a compilation of articles that you'd written about issues confronting South Africa, ended with those janitorial workers talking with these four white men who did this horrendous thing. And it's really a remarkable story, this forgiveness, this reconciliation.
Yeah.
Why do you think institutional reconciliation is so important?
Because, you know, our institutions are as afflicted by the history of apartheid and its cruelty as are individuals. And so the Dutch Reformed Church, for example, which is a white Afrikaans church that was the state church, if you will, has yet to come clean in a very public way and sort of say, we delivered the sermons, we produced the parishioners, you know. So institutions, I think, have to take responsibility, just as universities have to take responsibility, etc., etc. And without that, it's very difficult in our case for black people to come into former white institutions and trust the institution to act in their best interest.
The leader of the Youth League, of the ANC Youth League, was furious at your decision and, in fact, came to talk with you.
Right.
Remarkably, one of the first things you said to him was, I love you.
Yeah.
And you embraced him.
Yes.
And
this is the guy who said I should be killed.
You should be killed. You should be killed. That what these young boys did was a criminal act, and what you did in accepting them back at the university was a criminal act.
Right.
What was that like?
It, at that point, you know, you're very much unaware of yourself, and you're very aware of the influence of, in my own life, of God. You're very aware of the spiritual moment, and you're very aware of Mandela. You're very aware of the fact that you're not acting on your own, you're not setting a precedent, you're in fact doing exactly what the great Mandela did when he came out of prison. So little people like me say, given the space which I occupy, why can't we speak to anger, whether it's black anger or white anger, in a way that invites people into communion rather than push them away because they're angry? And it's a long road that obviously I had to walk in my own anger with white people, etc. But I'm very, very grateful to have worked with both white and black students over the years. That has really deeply changed me and enabled me to be able to embrace somebody who said, kill the man.
You were educated in South Africa at the University of the Western Cape.
Correct.
And from there you went, you studied abroad, first at Cornell where you earned your master's degree, and then on a Fulbright scholarship you studied at Stanford and earned your PhD. How important was that study abroad program?
Hugely important. You know, I have a very, very deep respect for the United States because I learned here the value of criticism, the importance of democracy, because at that point it was a foreign concept to us under apartheid, and the possibility, you know, of creating interracial or what we call non-racial relationships with other people based not on. Now, I'm sure you will tell me the U.S. still has a far road to travel, and yet you've made enormous progress. You know, I didn't think in my lifetime you'd have a black president. I didn't think in my lifetime you'd have achieved so much despite the long road ahead. That inspired many of us as black South Africans enormously, and then the tradition of democracy. So I was astounded, as my students often are these days when I send them to the U.S., I was astounded by how many white folk in the Presbyterian churches were actually solidly anti-apartheid and were solidly behind us and support. There's so many stories. That made a huge impact on me. So when I went back home, I said to myself, it is possible. You know, because remember at that point, Mandela's still in prison, so he didn't have the benefit of, you know, his own work of reconciliation. And that had a huge influence on me.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to go to university in the first place. So few black Africans had that opportunity, and you did. And your parents seem to have been remarkable people.
Oh, they were really fantastic. You know, because we grew up poor. They both, especially my mother, came from a middle-class black family. And so part of the anger for us as children was having that taken away.
Property. You had property taken.
Yeah, and given to white folk and all of that, and the huge health and other consequences for the family. So, but what was amazing about them, despite having had such great loss, you know, at many levels, not just material, they were absolutely dedicated and devout Christians who had a moral code, you know. I often say to people, because of my parents, I've never drunk wine in my life. I've never smoked, and my children are adopted. Two of those things are true, but they raised you.
And not that your children are adopted, they're not.
And they raised you in this cocoon, you know, in which even though there was poverty and oppression, all of that, you understood that your brother was your brother, your sister was your sister, that you never hit back, and that kind of stuff. And that made a huge difference. But I stumbled into university. I didn't know there's something called the university because my parents didn't go. Nobody in my community went to university. And I had a friend who went, and he said to me, go with me and check out this place called university. I said, why? What do they do there? He said, they study. I said, but I just studied at school. So study again. And so I sort of stumbled into it and didn't do too well initially. It was a huge gap between apartheid schooling and the demands of the university, etc. And the longer I stayed in university, the better I did. But the real, real jump for me was when I had the opportunity through Archbishop Tutu, he was then Bishop Tutu, to get a scholarship to study in the United States, because they had the foresight, him and some Americans on this side, that one day the country will change and we needed new leadership, particularly black South Africans. So I got in under that, came to Cornell. I was scared stiff. I didn't think I could do anything. And the people were famous and they wrote books and, you know, and I was a high school teacher. I was.
You taught biology.
Yeah, and I was scared stiff, you know. And the first day, I'll never forget this, I met Joe Novak at Cornell University and he said, you're the man from Africa, you know. Here's my manuscript. I'd like your comments on it before I send it to Harvard University Press. I mean, the first time I wet myself in public. I mean, I said, what on earth can I possibly say to the great man? But that's the beauty of your higher education system. I'm sure he appreciated my silly remarks on his manuscript. But what he was really trying to convey is, I believe in you. I think you can give me comments. That changed me forever.
And that's what you're trying to do for
Absolutely.
Other South Africans.
Absolutely.
One of the first things you tell them is you are smarter than you think you are, and you are smarter than people tell you you are. How important is that message?
Crucial, because we've ended up on both sides, both black and white young people, with this notion of victimhood. You know, somebody's out to get us. Okay, the black kid believes that white people are still in control and therefore they're disadvantaged. The white kids believe that black people are now in power and they are being disadvantaged. So I go in with this notion that you're not going to sulk, you're not going to play victim. I believe in you. You have enormous capacity to do good and to do well in your studies, because I'm half as smart as you, and my God, if I could get this opportunity and do something with it, you can do much better. So I come in, and I really believe this, you know, that young people in a system that doesn't expect much from anyone, our school system, the standards are so low, it's scary.
You say you can graduate from high school knowing 40%, getting 40% correct on the test.
Or 30% in some subjects. So the whole system downplays the potential of young people. My singular goal, as far as schools is concerned, is to send a message that is very countercultural, that of course you can do well. It's not your skin or anything else that determines that. I believe that, and the 25 schools we've taken on as a university while I'm president have just become so incredibly successful within 1 year.
Well, that's what's so interesting about what you do as rector and vice chancellor. You are actually going out into the townships, you are going to the primary schools, into the high schools, and you're taking that message to them, and as you said, you're bringing them under your wing, helping them to achieve what's necessary to make it to university. That's just so different from any college president I've ever heard.
Yeah, and it's scary, in fact, because I didn't budget for this. So I went to these schools, and one school had an average of 30% pass rate in grade 12, which is our end of school. And I said to them, okay, you know, if any of you pass well enough to come to university, you know, I might give you a scholarship. And I thought one or two might, you know, I mean, almost half the class did. And so I had to scramble for money just by telling the kids, you know, what they can do and then getting them the best teachers. You can actually change it.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPESU. I'm Patty Satalia. Jonathan Jansen is the rector and vice chancellor of the University of the Free State in South Africa. A gifted speaker and writer, he is the author of several award-winning books, including We Need to Talk and Knowledge in the Blood.
And at the same time, you're very concerned about access and, on the other hand, standards.
Absolutely.
So how do you accomplish both? How do you allow this opportunity and maintain the high standards of the University of the Free State?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we did, apart from trying to get into the schools before young people show up at the gate of the university, again, I've learned a lot of the stuff in your country. We put grade 10 kids in first year classes at university over weekends and holidays, so that by the time they come to the freshman year, they've already completed first year courses in chemistry or law and so on. The second thing we've done is to create a whole new campus, so that if you were failed by the school system, we'll give you an additional year or two, and we raise the money for it, so that by the time you're done with these small classes, very intensive instruction, bridging support, you can in fact then come into the mainstream degree programs of the university. We have a full campus on the South Campus, as we call it, and many of those young people have now become doctors and teachers and lawyers and accountants, simply by giving them another year or two. The premise being, they're not behind because of things they did wrong. They're behind because of a school system that doesn't work.
In fact, you went to a very dysfunctional school in, I believe, Cape Town, and you said, you are not the problem, we are the problem. How do you change that problem? 80% of the schools are dysfunctional, teachers not showing up, textbooks not available, no electricity, or in some case, plumbing.
Yeah. The first thing that you got to do is to look beyond the material resources. As important as they are, those are not the primary reasons kids do poorly. So what I discovered in South Africa was that our primary problem as far as black township schools are concerned is the lack of routine. So the first thing we do is we get a team together just to establish routine in the school. Like if you start at 7:30 in the morning, on the dot 7:30 you start to teach. And instead of ending at 3, you're going to end at 5 o'clock. We need to catch up for stuff you've lost in the earlier grades and so on. But just making sure there is a routine. You know, the same like raising kids. So at a very basic level, our problem is a routine because our schools are deeply, deeply dysfunctional. Once you've established that, that a teacher shows up who's qualified with a book in every subject and teaches, half your problems go away, even if that teacher, you know, struggles with material resources.
You are a teacher at heart, even as the vice chancellor. You, in fact, teach USF 101.
Freshman class.
Freshman class, a seminar, mandatory seminar class.
Yes.
And the whole idea behind it is to create decent human beings.
Absolutely.
Explain what you do in the 7-module course.
Again, stuff that I've learned in your country from Columbia University, for example, with the core curriculum, which is to sort of say, what are the 7 big questions that every undergraduate must grapple with? And so I get the most talented professors in the university, the senior people, and I sort of say, think of a question in astronomy that is important for all students to grapple with, even if they're not going to become scientists. In law, in ethics, in history, in the performing arts, and so on. I teach the history question, which is how should we deal with our violent past? And you teach it not to convey content, but to convey a set of skills about how to think about everyday dilemmas. Initially, the students revolt. They don't want this stuff. They say, I came here to be a chartered accountant. What are you doing?
They consider it useless. Astronomy.
Yeah. Now, it's the most popular cause, because they understand that there's a difference between being trained as an engineer
educated.
And being educated.
How do you divide your time? I don't know how you sleep, because you're a prolific writer, you have an open door policy, students come in, they don't necessarily need an appointment, you're out in the townships, you're talking with people, you're addressing issues that are critical to South Africa. How do you fit it all in, and how do you prioritize?
Yeah, in almost any job is that I have an agreement with my board. And that agreement is, if you're expecting me to sit behind a desk all day and sign leave forms, you got the wrong guy. You know, if you want me to make this a really exciting place for teaching and learning and new ways of thinking about management and so on, then allow me to assemble a team of people who are really, really good at the other levels and that can do the mundane stuff, because I'm not good at it. So of course I manage the budget, of course I manage recruitment and so on. But most of the drive for that stuff happens with really competent people who are better than I am at doing those kinds of things. And that frees me up then to also do the other thing.
Also, you have this sort of simple approach to leadership. You have two or three things that are really critical to you, and you invest all of your energies into those. What are they right now? What are those two or three things that are critical?
Well, the two big issues for me at our university, in our context, is number one, really improving and deepening human relationships, okay? Because you're talking about 350 years of colonialism and apartheid. I know in my heart of hearts that that's not going to, the effects disappear simply because of good intentions or good policies and so on and so forth. So I invest a huge amount of time and have to do even more of those things in the next few months in trying to just get our faculty and our students and the broader community to agree on some basic things like the embrace of the stranger. For example.
The embrace of the stranger.
Yeah. So, you know, that is...
And what you mean by that is, you know, there are incidents in South Africa and in this country where the foreigner is attacked.
The foreigner is attacked, but the foreigner is not always foreign in the sense of being from somewhere else. The foreigner is gay and not straight. The foreigner is Catholic and not Dutch Reformed. The foreigner, you know, is poor and not wealthy and black and not white, etc., etc., etc. And so working very, very hard to find ways of doing that. The second big issue for me is raising the academic standard. I believe that Africa, Southern Africa in particular, must have some of the best universities in the world. I make no apology for that. I was privileged to study in this country at some of the best universities, and I know it's not difficult to achieve that. So keeping very high academic standards, but also building very strong human standards, those are the only two things I really want to do.
In your book, Knowledge in the Blood, you say that blacks and whites share a mutual destiny and mutual vulnerability. We're in this mess together.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what it's going to take to undo the harm of apartheid.
I know this sounds harsh, and when I do many, many talks and workshops across South Africa, the older people normally get upset with me, but I say to them, listen, given limited time, there is not much I can do for you if you're 60 years old and you served in the white military and you have all this bitter stuff, black or white, that you carry with you. There's not much I can do for you, but I can do a lot for your kids. So allow me to work with these 18-year-olds as they come into university, and most of them, not all, most of them will become the new leaders with a new vision that is generous towards other people and that is countercultural in terms of the politics of the day. So for me, that is the primary goal, is try to get young people. And I think in two or three generations from now, we'll be fine. The problem is you can't simply do that as a university president. You also have to do that at other levels of leadership, domestic leadership in the home, corporate leadership in the workplace, public sector leadership in government.
And is that happening?
No, that's the problem. And of course, community leadership, you know, in the voluntary sector. And we don't have that. We don't have a lot of political leadership. We don't have a lot of leadership that is generous, that is Mandelian, if you will, in that sense. And so I often feel that some of us are up against it. But that's the appeal, at least.
You say that the rainbow nation that you and others aspire to, for so many South Africans, has only been the rain.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. You know, certainly in South Africa, I would say in many of these forums, you know, at the most simple level, start with your kids. Make sure that the kinds of people that come through your home don't look like you, pray like you, make love like you, come from where you come, and so on and so forth.
And that was your childhood.
That was, in a very powerful way. And you then lay imprint on their hearts and in their minds a notion of humanity that is much larger than what we inherited. 2 weeks ago, I met with church leaders in the Bloemfontein community where our university is, and I said to them, when last did you preach on racism in your church? And they all said, we don't. I said, well, that's why we still have problems, you know. So it's trying to get people where they are, where they work, to do simple things, and that is talk about the difficult stuff. Now, of course, the common South African experience, I'm sure in the U.S. as well, can we just leave slavery alone? Can we just move forward?
Right, let's not talk about it.
And my argument has always been, that's fine. The problem is the past keeps showing up.
Unless you talk about it.
Unless you talk about it.
Speaking of talking, you wrote a book called Letters to My Children, which started off as tweets that you were sending to your own two children.
Yeah.
Tweets in 140 characters or less about love and life and about being a good human being. Yeah. Explain how that took off at the university and really nationwide.
Yeah, you know, it was a very simple idea. And, you know, I suppose it's a sign of getting old. People would always say to me, what is your advice on children with learning disabilities? What is your advice on race relations? I said to myself, you know, I've been privileged to learn quite a lot from leadership and so on. Let me just put out a tweet, and I would sort of say, tweet number one, this, tweet number two, that, you know. One of the early tweets was, condoms break, you know, and you can imagine the Catholic response and people sort of saying, this is too ambiguous, you know, what does this mean? And the whole idea was to have a little bit of ambiguity and yet convey a message. And then I stopped for a week, and I got very angry phone calls from parents and so on saying, I read your tweet every morning before my kids go to school. Why have you stopped? You know, where are the tweets? And so I said, okay, somebody's reading it. So I put this out again. And I went from like 5,000 followers, I right now have about 59,000 followers. And people sort of cottoned onto this idea that there might be some, you know, common wisdoms about life and living and learning and loving that might be useful. So it just took off, and I quite enjoyed doing it.
And they're wonderful. It's a wonderful read. What you say about your writing is that you aim and you hope, your expectation and your hope is that 50% of those who read it will be upset, and the next thing you write, you hope the other 50% will be upset.
Now, I mean, yes, as a columnist, I mean, the biggest threat you face is being irrelevant. And so part of what I figured out is that you've got to constantly talk to things that affirm people in their struggle to make a better South Africa and so on. But you also have to speak to the things they struggle with. And so for me, because I'm fairly Catholic in my ambitions for not just South Africa but the world, I'm deeply internationalist in my thinking and so on and so forth. And so I can speak to a range of issues in my life without, in fact, feeling trapped. So people often try to describe me ideologically, and they have all sorts of difficulty because I don't fit in a box. And that gives me the platform, you know, to sort of talk more broadly. And predictably, half the people are going to be very upset when you talk about things like homophobia. The other half will be very upset.
And this is coming from a Catholic.
Right. And the other half would get very upset when you talk about other things. And for me, that's important because you've got to keep people's respect, but you have to constantly push into areas that you know. And I'm very alert to the kinds of things people struggle with. And so I listen to conversations, I listen to radio stations and what people call in shows and so on. And you sort of have a sense of the things you must speak to.
So what are the principles that guide your daily life and your decisions?
The notion that I must be able to, for example, feel the pain of the Palestinian mother whose kid was just blown up by an Israeli tank, as I must feel the pain of the Israeli mother who just lost her child from a bomb on a bus in Tel Aviv. And this is not sort of moral equivalence. This is not sort of saying, you know, let's just flatten the world and love everybody. This is sort of saying, can you as a human being feel pain and move from that of people whom you've never met, who don't live within your borders, who don't believe what you believe? Can you feel pain and from that premise begin to talk about what is the approach for change? That is fundamental to who I am.
All right. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Jonathan Janssen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jonathan Janssen, the first black president of the University of the Free State in South Africa. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.